Benjamin, let's talk about the Apple TV this week.
The Apple TV. For a change, we're talking about the actual Apple TV set-top box.
Not the app.
Yeah. Not the app. Or the subscription service that a lot of people call Apple TV. Even though it's
Apple TV. That's right. Yeah, so we have a few things to mention here this week. And this is all based on this service provider, Swiss service provider.
Yeah,
in Switzerland. The story here is that they replaced their set-top box with Apple TVs for customers, which is like a cool thing to do. I mean, that seems pretty innovative. But then through feedback based on the TV remote that comes with the Apple TV, they needed to design their own. Is that the story?
Yeah. So it seems like Apple's doing deals with quite a lot of these, you know, random smaller like cable companies and countries and around the world just to replace their like proprietary cable boxes with Apple TV 4Ks. You have obviously this Swiss company. There's Charter Spectrum, I think, in the US, right? And then there's Vodafone just recently did it in the UK. EE does it in the UK. Like Apple's like making the Apple TV like a mini cable box, basically. And when you get into one of these deals, what you get is the Apple TV that comes pre-installed with the app of the cable network. And then you can go to the cable network and they have all their, you know, video content. And then you can obviously get all of the standard apps from the App Store. And all these cable channels are like, all these cable networks are advertising that, oh, it also comes with a free year of Apple TV Plus, but of course you get that from buying an Apple TV 4K outright. So basically, you're just licensing an Apple TV 4K through a monthly plan of some description, right? Although what's funny is this cable network fiber telecoms company in Ireland, EIR, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, but that's the spelling, they recently changed over to offering a plan where the cable box is an Apple TV 4K, and everyone's furious about it because, you know, with a normal cable box, which is like an integrated DVR, you get your cable channels, you can just scroll the list of channels and you can record one, right? And then you can record another, and then you go on the hard drive and you play back your recordings. Well, obviously the Apple TV 4K, you know, obviously it has 32 or 64 gigs of storage, but you can't just record live TV on it. You only get the facilities of the apps. And so the EAR official app had a way to like stream all the live channels, but they didn't have the rights to record them through the Apple TV. So for whatever reason, this cable company had offers like 90 channels and they only had rights to record 9 of them. And they weren't even like the big ones, right? They were like the channels no one cares about through Apple TV's app. So people were upgrading their boxes to the Apple TV 4K and losing, you know, a key functionality of their old cable boxes, which is to record live TV. So there's a lot of upset going on at the moment in Ireland about, you know, functionality, and clearly in Switzerland, their customers were annoyed about the remote situation. The Apple TV remote, this seems like a good a time as any to kind of look at it again, because we are, you know, we believe there is an Apple TV hardware refresh coming sometime soon. Like, we've seen code evidence.
It's in the lab.
Yeah, in the lab, in development, right? It's as coming soon as the banker is. It's like, and who knows whether it will just be a simple like spec bump, or A12 chip, I think is what we believe is going to come in, or if they'll actually do something more substantial with the hardware or and the remote, right? And the remote is very controversial because it's symmetrical, it's small, it's mostly focused on the trackpad, touchpad area at the top, and then you have like 4 buttons on it. Now, some people hate the remote, and some people find it okay, and some people like it. I kind of like fall somewhere in the middle. Like, I like the touchpad part of it. It's so much better than a classic remote, which just has buttons and like a D-pad, because you can flick through like 5 items at a time just with one swipe, whereas instead of them going right, down, 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 you can like fling around. Of course, and you get like the momentum scrolling and it feels really nice and it gives you a kind of like iOS experience just scrolling through all these things, and it's cool. And it's useful because you can scroll a really, really, really long list really, really quickly. It kind of reminds me of the old days where you'd have like the iPod click wheel and then you have competitor MP3 players which just had a D-pad up, down, and you'd like go down, 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 down. It isn't as precise, obviously, because you momentum scroll all the way down. You might overshoot by a couple of items. You have to go back up. And there are people that have issues with like accidental inputs where they want to scroll to the right but accidentally end up scrolling down. So, you know, it's definitely debated whether it's good or not. I think the trackpad's good. The buttons are not so good for ergonomics because they're all the same shape, basically, and you can't really tell what you're clicking on, especially as the fact the remote is mirrored vertically, right? So you can accidentally pick it up the wrong way, and you need some pretty sensitive fingers to be able to tell if you're touching the glass bit or the trackpad bit. So very, very often you'll pick up the remote upside down and press mute when you wanted to press menu. So that side of it, I don't love. But if they were going to do a second gen remote, I wouldn't want them to ditch the trackpad for just like a blinded D-pad. In my head, a better at Siri remote would essentially be a bigger version of the remote that you have now, which would allow them to have an overall bigger unit, so it's harder to just like lose down the sofa. You'd get slightly more ability to put your fingers where you want and hold it. You wouldn't have to like cradle your little fingers around it to actually use the thing, right? Because it's tight. It's like a chocolate bar. If they just made it like twice as wide, you'd get a bigger surface, so you could be more precise in where you're dragging around. And then what I think they should probably have is like buttons around the trackpad. So you'd have like the swipey bit in the middle, and then you'd have an actual button for going left and an actual button for going right. Because one of the biggest pain points is if you're trying to do like 15-second skip, the gesture on the Apple TV remote is you have to move your finger to the very, very edge of the trackpad and then click down, right? Yep. And that is annoying.
It's invisible.
And unreliable. It kind of works, but it kind of doesn't. So I think in my head, they should have a trackpad, but they should also have more buttons for, you know, essential inputs like going forward and back, and then do something to make it asymmetrical so when you pick it up the wrong way, you know what's, you know, which way's up. What do you think about the Apple TV remote? Are you hoping they change the remote design significantly, etc., etc.?
Yeah, so I mean, they have changed it once, you know, where they between the Apple TV 4, now called the Apple TV HD, and the Apple TV 4K, they revised the remote in such a way that the only change was to add a white rubbery ring around the menu button, and then that became the new remote for both boxes. So it wasn't just if you had the 4K box; it was if you bought a new Apple TV of any sort, this is what you got. And that seemed to be that you can at least tell, you know, orientation a little bit better, because like other than that, it was sort of, you've got the volume button, which is connected, the plus and the minus are on one big toggle. And so you can sort of orient that way. And then there's, I think, like a little dot or like some sort of a raised part on one of the other buttons, maybe the Siri button.
If you get forensic about it, the microphone it's very button minor. Like bevels inwards, and the plus, the play pause button, bevels outwards. So if you get down to the molecular level with your fingers, the design of each button is actually slightly different. And obviously the menu button has the ring. So giving the menu button the ring differentiated it from the TV button, which is otherwise identical to the menu button. And then you have the microphone button that bevels downwards, and the play pause button that is like embossed, basically pushes outwards. It's concave and convex, those buttons. And then you have the double height volume control.
Yeah, and in general, I would say that I would hope that they don't overcorrect the problem with the remote, because I think there is like a design issue with the remote, that they did innovate with it compared to the old D-pad style remote, and all silver one with like the circle and the little button, you know, and that was like a super simple remote. The new one, I think, is definitely like worth that upgrade. So I'd hate to go back, but the experience in my family has been that I'll think of a few people. So myself, I can master anything, you know, it's figure it out and then get used to it, even if it's like a terrible remote. With company, it has taken for like my mother-in-law to control the TV. I have had to say, like, for the very first time, like, oh, it's like a trackpad, you know, like on a computer, like on a laptop. And then it's like, oh, okay, now I get it. But as soon as you say that, it's not obvious to the remote, but once you figure it out, then you can control it. And it really fits with the UI. And then if it is like too fast for movement and you like overshoot stuff, that's all stuff that can be fixed in software, like tuning it, whether it's what the default is, or you need to like change it to be less sensitive or more sensitive. Things like the skip forward to skip backward, you know, they can teach that in the UI, but it's only during the setup, and like maybe only one person sets it up, and so you don't see that otherwise. Having something to indicate that would be useful. Even things that they've added over time, like the ability to swipe on the right side of the remote or the trackpad, So it's on the top of it, but it's like the top right surface. And then you can scroll through a list as if you were like pressing on a screen, the little alphabetical list. You know,
yeah, the metaphor for that is like long pressing on the little scroll bar on the phone and dragging it up and down to scroll through it really fast, right? It's like that, but obviously there's no visual indication because it's just a trackpad.
And that's a feature that's been added since their remote was designed. So if they could put something, you know, on their remote to sort of suggest that. But in general, I really do like their remote. Like, I was thinking about it, and you know, I've got the Apple TV 4K in the living room, and I can control that from the LG TV's remote, and they call it like a magic wand or something, because it's like a Wiimote where you can motion it and move a cursor on the screen, and that's a cool feature. And it wouldn't be terrible if the Apple TV A worked with that feature from LG, and so like if you wanted to use your TV's remote, you could do that and then like move a cursor around on screen, because it's pretty good for like you want to get from this corner to that corner very quickly without swiping or, you know, doing a D-pad. And they don't have the sort of trackpad. It's like that or D-pad. But I do like that sort of like motion navigation, you know, motion and then select. It works really well.
You said you don't have like the overshooting problem when you've just got like controlling the cursor essentially by moving.
Yeah, it's still sensitive to like your motion. So like if you've got a shaky hand, then it's not going to be very precise. And you can change the size of your cursor, and you can even make it like a big bird. So it's like not just a cursor, it's like something different. But it's a different, you know, it's a different approach, and it works really well. And so what would be cool is if Apple, you know, you've technically got like D-pad navigation from left to right, right? Where you can, I think you can on the home screen, if you're not just on your home screen, I think you can click on the buttons left and right.
Yeah, if you tap, if you're on the home screen and you tap the very left edge and the very right edge and the very top edge and the very bottom edge, it will go up, down, left, right.
Yeah, another invisible feature. Like you said, if you just had some markings on there or buttons on there.
Yeah, like if they just had the trackpad but made it bigger and just had like, here's an arrow for the left, here's an arrow for the right, here's a line so you know if you like go on this bit, you zoom through the alphabetical thing. Like just some like visual markings to know what you can actually do. That'd be better too.
I don't think that the remote that Salt made is what they should do, because that's like an overcorrection. It's like you might as well, you know, make that an option that you can buy, but not have it be the default in the box, or make that default, but have like this other option that you can buy for this different experience. Because I do like the Siri remote and the trackpad navigation. And, you know, like I mentioned before, so I've got the LG TV in the living room with Apple TV 4K attached to it. And we mainly use the Apple TV, so we can get by with just the Siri remote, with things like clicking it, the TV comes on from the Apple TV coming on from HDMI CEC. You can hold down the menu button, and then you can put the Apple TV to sleep. The actual TV goes to sleep. You've got volume. There's no need for a channel button because it's all, you know, from the apps. And that works really well for us. But in the bedroom, we've got the Samsung Smart TV with AirPlay 2 and the Apple TV app. So, we don't need an Apple TV in there. And that was part of my whole experiment, was like, can you get by without an Apple TV? For like secondary TVs, I think it's nice to have an Apple TV for your main, you know, viewing room, but not it's overkill in bedrooms once you've got AirPlay 2 and the Apple TV app. And it works good enough, but the thing that I miss often is voice input. And there are TVs that have voice input, like, you know, Samsung TVs, Vizio TVs, Sony TVs, you know, that have the Apple TV app and AirPlay 2. But this particular one doesn't. It's like $280. So it's like, you know, it's an LED, not an OLED. And it's 4K, but again, not an OLED. And it's like 43 inches. So it's like $280, not much more than an Apple TV box itself.
Which is insane, but yeah.
which is insane. And, you know, you can view all the same content and you can AirPlay to it. So that's really neat. But the thing that I often miss, and then I'll think, do I want to watch this show now here, or do I want to, you know, read or something, is well, I've got to get the remote and navigate and, you know, click through and find all the stuff. Whereas on the Apple TV, I think the UI is, I mean, it's just faster having like a dedicated box processing that, and maybe higher end TVs have better processors inside. So it's like faster to load up apps and navigate and everything. So it's slow on the Samsung TV that I've got. But the something I realized this week that makes it really slow for me is that there's no voice input on the remote. And like the LG TV's remote, it's got a voice input. So it's a much higher end, you know, thing. It doesn't work with the Apple TV part. It's just for the LG TVs part. But it made me realize, like, man, voice input is really critical for just like fat, quickly finding something. Like, if you know exactly what you want to watch, being able to say that, or even just like launch the app that way, it's really useful. To where now, like, if the remote doesn't have voice control, it kind of is a non-starter for me. You know, like, I'm not going to change the bedroom TV right now, but I'm always curious about, maybe I should add like a Roku TV box or something, you know, that's $30 or, you know, whatever, to just to add voice control. Like, that would be the reason, not TVOS.
Yeah.
So for that, like, it's critical. I don't see that voice control is on the Salt, or, you know, the Salt remote. No, it's definitely not on like Apple's old IR remote. You know, and if it is built into my LG remote, like it is, it doesn't work with TVOS. So they would need to offer some integration there. And there are there's like two third party home kit compatible remotes for Apple TV.
Yeah, they're like the,
but they're really expensive.
Yeah, they're like the old kind of like Harmony and Crest and those kind of companies that make like whole home, smart home solutions.
Yeah, and those do integrate with Siri.
Yes, and so they have like you have to add them to the home app. Yeah. And they're essentially like remotes that have existed for 10 years with the old, you know, smart home world of like X10 and those kind of technologies.
Yeah.
And they took the remote and they just added a way to communicate with the Apple TV as well.
Yeah, and they're really expensive and they're really overkill and they're kind of clunky compared to like it kind of replicates what you can do in the home app, but on a remote. So if you didn't want it in your phone, which is really accessible to you, but you want it as like a living room device without having like a dedicated iPad in the living room or something, then those remotes do that. But that seems to be kind of what's missing, is that you can do any IR remote with the Apple TV. You can do the app. You can use game controllers to navigate and do a bunch of stuff now. But the thing that's kind of missing for me is voice control. And if you could do, you know, just basic voice control with TVOS, like they've allowed you to do with those smart home remotes, but, you know, let you do it with like the LG's Magic Wand remote, or I'm sure Samsung has voice control in some of their remotes, you know, and that kind of thing, then I think that'd be, you could kind of satisfy a lot of people, because you show it like the one remote thing and there's nothing that you'd miss out on. Because I can't think of anything that I can't do navigation wise with the LG's remote. You know, maybe you've got to do a couple of clicks, like there's no like home button, because there's a home button in the remote.
Long press and stuff.
I don't know. Maybe you can't long press, but like the biggest thing is that you can't. I mean, you can play pause. You can do volume. You can go back. There's like a back button for that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Could you activate the control center from the LG remote? Because you'd have to long press the TV button normally. I'm not sure you'd be able to do that.
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't try it right now. But I know the one thing that I can't do is go from like three levels deep into an app back to the home screen. You've got to do back, or maybe long press to get back. But I could activate the screensaver, because that's like the menu button from the home screen. But yeah, there's no like the home button. And does the Salt remote doesn't have a home button either. It's got the menu button, but there's no button for home to go like right to the home screen. So it's really not special at all.
Yeah, that was like the other part of this story. Is everyone's hyping up this, you know, Switzerland Salt remote. Oh, it's only available in Switzerland. I want to buy one. Can I get it imported? I'm, you know, flipping out. Why will Apple not sell this elsewhere? Like, it's just an infrared remote. The original coverage of it from some places was like Salt has partnered with Apple on this. They're doing, you have to like add it to the TV OS 13. It requires TV OS 13. It sounded like it was like a Bluetooth remote or something, and it had some, you know, secret source in it. No, now in the light of day, we have realized it is just a plain Jane infrared remote that gives you the same capabilities as any other infrared remote. It doesn't have a microphone in it or anything like that. The only thing that makes it slightly different is that the menu button does directly look like the Apple's Siri remote menu button, including the white ring around it. So maybe Salt asked Apple if they could use that design for the menu button. But otherwise than that, you could make this entire remote without any collaboration with, you know, the first party company.
Yeah. And one last thing I'll say on voice control, which is not the Salt remote, you know, and that I think is really essential, is that, I guess two things. First is that my daughter, who is six, she is like, there's certain things she likes to watch on YouTube, and so she knows how to navigate YouTube and like find the thing that she wants to watch. But you know, obviously, it's harder to do on the TV than it is like on the iPad. So oftentimes she'll tell me what she wants to watch, and then like my job is to go and find it. And that could be a bunch of steps with search and everything. But I've told her, if you just say search for whatever, whatever on YouTube, then it'll search YouTube. So you can't say like look for whatever, whatever, and it'll include it if it's on YouTube. You've got to say on YouTube or using YouTube. But as long as you include that, then that's like the shortcut from anywhere to do a search query in the YouTube app, and then you can, and then she can navigate and find the results. So with just the Apple TV, the Siri remote, like she is really good at doing that with the voice search. So again, like where it's essential for convenience for me, and right now for her, it's like essential for, I think, achieving, you know, what she wants to do. And that scales, you know, from a 6-year-old girl to anybody who wants to do something quickly on their TV and the living room. And so I do have the issues with the Siri remote where it's small, so it gets lost. If it was bigger, it might not be as much of an issue. Or if it had like rubberized edges or something, you know, it wasn't so sleek, then it wouldn't, you know, fall into the couch cushions easily. And anytime it's on the couch with us while we're watching TV, someone will move in such a way that it gets like clicked. So something that was like ignore clicks without motion, or you know, they made it more like, now they've got all these pressure sensitive things like with the AirPods Pro, where you got to really squeeze it to get a reaction out of it. If they did something more like that where you could ignore accidental inputs, that would be nice. And so those are some things. But then also, like, if I had to think about how to improve the Apple TV experience, because I do like the remote, give it, even though it's got some issues that I would try to improve. I enjoy using the physical remote more than the app, I'll say that. And but so much of what I would improve is not in the hardware, even the remote, it's in the software. It's in, like, you know, how good is voice search? So, you know, where does it take you? What does it pull from? What are options? Like, how confusing is the UI? You know, if you want to find something, how quickly can you get to it? Like, there was this whole thing, you know, where I read a thing several years ago where it was like, I preferred the UI of third-party apps on the old Apple TV box because they had to fit into this, like, layout that Apple provided.
They were essentially standardized, right?
Correct. And they couldn't do creative things, but they also couldn't make a bad app. And then when the Apple TV 4 came out, it was like all of a sudden Netflix and Hulu has the same app as they have on Roku and wherever else. And it breaks the UI, like, you know, it doesn't fit in. And you can learn the app itself, but they can also make some very bad decisions visually. And they did, and they have, and now they're normal, but it used to be better. So that's one thing. But then the other thing is, like, Apple's own apps, like for TV, if you bought a season of a show, simple things like autoplay weren't there. And the way that they would, like, if you had every episode of like an 8-season show, it was just linear, like how you got to it. And it wasn't like pick a season, pick a show.
That's still on that, by the way.
Yeah.
If you buy all the episodes, it's like they're, you know, the whole season, entire season things, which are normally discounted. So if you do want to buy multiple seasons, it's often cheaper to buy that bundle than buying like 2 seasons of the actual show by itself. If you buy it like that, it's still just in one big list. You have to buy per season if you want the nice organization, which is just ridiculous. But that is how the status quo is with the TV app.
Yep. So those are the things that I would say, like, spend some time on those, you know, and there's, you know, you could do it in any update. It could be tvOS 14. It could be tvOS 15. And like, those are things that you would want to apply down to the Apple TV 4 box and not just be like a new hardware. But Apple could do all of it. They could do the remote. They could do the software. They could, but they haven't done much, you know, except for add the little white ring. but yeah,
what I mean, you know, like what you were saying before about like your daughter or whatever, it made me think of the Logitech crayon compared to the Apple Pencil.
Oh yeah,
it's a very similar analogy.
Yeah, yeah. Let Logitech, like Belkin, you know, somebody else make a different remote for different needs.
Yeah, which is actually Bluetooth and does have, you know, mic input,
voice control. It's like made for Apple TV certified. That would be smart, and not have it be like this several hundred dollars smart home remote that basically replicates an app on your phone. You know. Yeah, that's kind of my take. And then, I mean, like, the biggest thing, you take voice control, it's almost a shame that you even need to have a remote in the age of like a HomePod that can always listen to a buzzword, and Amazon having Fire TV boxes that can listen for the command, you know, just have like full voice control. even on iOS and iPad OS, like you can kind of control your device just with voice, but on the Apple TV, there's no, this is a box plugged into a wall that has no power restraint. And this is a HomePod with loaded with microphones. Those two can't talk to each other and you know, give off commands. There's a little bit of integration there where you can say, like, to your iPhone, you know, voice command Siri, play The Lion King on the living room TV. And that's a new feature that they built out last year, and it works really well. But there's nothing that says, here's Siri on a HomePod in the living room, command that to control the TV. And then the TV itself, Amazon's been able to do it, yeah, they need to have an option for that where you can say built into the Apple TV box is, you know, listens for the command and you control it. And they haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame it, how you said the remote does have issues, but it's not the number one issue with the Apple TV experience. I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my mom does have this situation where she's got the cable provider where her cable box is the Apple TV. It wasn't started that way. It began as like the cable box got replaced, I think. And then she happened to have an Apple TV. And then she just used that instead of the new box to rent or something. But then that's the situation where she's got an app for the cable provider, and then she goes into that and it's got the live TV, like, you know, basic UI like Hulu with live TV. And they might even have DVR, like a better situation with DVR where you can record. I think they do. But that works well for them. Like, and, you know, and I would hear if it was a battery remote from my mom and my stepdad, of like, you know, what can we do to fix this? And like, it works for them. I think it works for a lot of people. I think it's one of those situations where, you know, if you hate it, you really hate it, and you hear a lot about the problems.
Yeah, and you can buy the Apple infrared remote still from the Apple Store, and it's not that expensive, and that will work with the Apple TV if you just want an actual D-pad. This week, Happy Hour is sponsored by Defense by Xdoria. For a limited time, Happy Hour listeners can get 20% off Defense's excellent shield cases for the latest iPhone 11 and older iPhone models too. Use promo code 20925. The shield case is certified to military grade standard, surviving drops up to 3 meters. It combines a soft, bubble pattern rubber interior with a hard polycarbonate shell. You can also use our exclusive deal from Defense to pick up its Defense Duo Qi wireless charger. The Defense Vertical Duo Charger has two charging pads, so you can wirelessly charge your phone and another Qi-compatible device, like AirPods, at the same time. It comes with an included USB-C cable, a quick charge 3.0 power supply, and an extra USB outlet on the back to charge a third device. The deals are part of our new 9to5 Mac Holiday Deal Hub that launched this week, offering exclusive deals on iPhone and Mac accessories, so definitely go and check that out as well. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. Thank you again to Defense by Xdoria for sponsoring. Visit defensebrand.com and use code 20925 at checkout for 20% off. That promo code again is #2, #0, #9, #TO, and #5. And that's defensebrand.com.
All right, Mayo, let's talk about something a little bit different from Apple TV hardware. And this is mostly about TV Plus, the service, and awards, which were kind of a big question about, you know, Apple and the service. So what's happening now officially with awards and Apple TV Plus?
Yeah, so last week we discussed how Apple was giving out awards very feebly to apps and games. And this week they got nominated for awards. So they haven't won any yet, because obviously the award ceremonies for TV stuff generally happen in January. But the month before, everyone's announcing the nominations. And Apple has, in their words, made history by becoming the first streaming service to get critical acclaim from the Golden Globes, with 3 nominations for the morning show. And they call it making history because, according to them, no other streaming service has got awards within the first year. So... Yeah. Now, that on its own is a bit of very sly, like, creative marketing. Because if you think of, like, Apple's streaming service as Apple TV Plus, then sure, their first original content is only a month old. But, you know, Apple as a company has done more questionable original content like Planet the Apps 3 years ago, and they didn't win any awards for that. So just because you rebrand what your offering is doesn't necessarily change the underlying fact. If you look at like Hulu and Netflix, Hulu did like cheap comedies in their first year of original content, so obviously they didn't win any awards for that, and then they actually won awards when they started doing, you know, proper dramas. And similarly with Netflix, they did a very low budget thing for their first year, and as soon as they started investing with like Orange is the New Black and House of Cards, they actually won nominations in their first year too. So Apple's going very fast and loose with the making history claims here, and it would be, I'd probably laugh at that claim even if it was like fully true, because, you know, making history, it's not a historic moment. But even if you ignore that part of it, realistically, it's not like a huge achievement. But it is notable that they spent, you know, a lot of money on these shows, and they have actually managed to get like prestigious nominations from the Golden Globes. They've also got awards from like the Critics' Choice Awards and a few other places, but the Golden Globes are like the big, you know, they're big TV awards. And they got 3 on the morning show for Best TV Drama, and then they got one for the stars of Aniston and Witherspoon for Best Actress Performance in a Drama.
Nice.
Like, it's good, and you have to, like, Apple's motivation for TV Plus in the first year has been heavily focused on winning awards, or at least getting awards recognition, because, you know, they're giving it away to so many people, they can't really measure it on money, really, because the hard money only starts coming into effect next year.
Well, I think the practical thing of all this too is that everything they've done so far is based on like some obscure idea of what the service will be. It's a big mystery of how people will watch it and where it'll be available. And people signed on, like they were able to buy content and put together a service without anything to show for what their product would be. And that was tricky for Apple. Now at least they've got something to show. They're like, this, do you want to be a part of this, you know, to attract talent? But then also, aside from that, they can say, we're an award winning service. So, you know, do you want to be among this class of content?
Yeah. And when they do like start pushing hard for people to always pay, they can be, we have award winning shows, like, yeah, or award nominated shows, like, because if you actually go into the TV app right now and you go to the TV Plus channel, there's a big banner. Golden Globes nominated the morning show. they definitely, you know, gunning for it.
And if you nominations are good enough, yeah, in many cases.
Like, I'd be surprised if they actually win this time around, because they have tough competition every year, of course. But it is significant they at least got nominated. And yeah, there are only like 5 choices in every category, so there's only 5 dramas in a year that can get nominated, and they managed to get one for the morning show. So that is, you know, strong. And they got Best Actress for both leads. If you actually look behind the scenes a little bit, you know, as much as Apple has been plowing money into the shows themselves, they've been plowing money into sweet-talking all the voters that vote for these awards as well. So, like, Hollywood, you know, somehow everything in Hollywood just comes down to money. Apple's been, you know, giving out remember we talked a few months ago how they gave away the vouchers in the Emmy magazine? That was to people that vote on the Emmys. They've been hosting parties like every weekend for that. They just invite notable people in the industry that do, you know, many of which are members of the association that vote on these things and nominate for these things. They've been asking their like leading cast to give up weekends just to come to these parties and these mixes and these, you know, conversations. They've hosted events at Variety. They've, you know, we even saw on like websites like the, you know, like Hollywood media websites like Hollywood Report and stuff, they would have adverts that were just targeted to people that vote in these awards, saying,
yeah,
for your consideration,
those, right?
Here's the morning show. Like, they've been spending so much money just to get the awards, as well as actually the show content. And at least in some form, they have succeeded.
Yeah, so if they win is the next question.
I'd be surprised if they win. But what you have to also remember is that the people that Apple also, as part of these parties, Apple screened the final episodes of the morning show. They made big events for like the finales and stuff. And at least according to The Guardian, who originally panned the morning show in its November 1st embargo date, they basically said it was like, you know, a load of rubbish in the first 3 episodes. This one critic has been very much converted, and he said it's one of the best season finales of the decade. So maybe that's why it's been nominated, because apparently the season finale is very, very good, at least according to this one, you know, publication. So who knows? Maybe they will win, but if it's one of the best of the decade, they got a good shot. But that's obviously only the opinions of one person.
In my
opinion, they don't deserve to win this year. The morning show is good. I don't think it's like the best thing on television, right? Or I certainly, obviously we've only seen 8 episodes to date. The 8th episode was very, very striking and moving and serious and, you know, compelling. But the rest of the season doesn't quite hold up to that level of fantasticness. It's good, but it's not like, you know, Golden Globe winning, in my opinion. But I'm not voting for them, so there you go.
Yeah, I was looking at the Golden Globe Awards website to see who is Apple competing against. So you say you don't think they should win. Well, who would win then? And so in the best television series drama category, like you mentioned, there's 5 that can be nominated. There is Big Little Lies. There's The Crown, which is, I think, Netflix. And yep. Then there's Killing Eve, which is BBC America. There's The Morning Show. And then there's Succession, which is, I think, HBO. I think Big Little Lies is Showtime or HBO. So, yeah, like you're right that there is some tough competition in terms of, like, what critics and viewers like this year. The Morning Show is sort of, like, it might be the most obscure in that category. And it's almost kind of gimmicky to include it, but...
It's just so new, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's only a month old, essentially.
Yeah. I don't know that it's fit into the... I mean, you know, who knows what they're looking for in these nominations, but I listen to a lot of podcasts about, like, media and everything and this kind of stuff, and you don't hear about... You hear about it in the context of, like, it's new part of Apple, and it's all right, but not, like, this is, like, something that you must see.
Yeah, like, you hear people talk about Succession and Big Little Lies and stuff, like, constantly. And
yeah.
The Munn Show isn't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, every show on Apple TV Plus last week was sort of in that category of, like, heavy hitting. And
they were good.
They were good.
But they were, like, somewhat depressing at the same time.
Yes.
But that is, I guess, one of the definitions of drama, isn't it? Like, if you're not hard-hitting, then you're not a good drama.
This is, like, the first week going in where I don't have an episode of C to watch because it's been finaled, you know, for the first season, so... I haven't started any of the new stuff yet. I'm waiting until to finish the first run of shows, and I can just binge and catch up if I like it.
Last week I was complaining that they had nothing coming soon.
Uh-huh. For January. Yeah.
This, as of today, we have one official confirmation that Little America, the anthology series, will be debuting on January 17th. I have good reason to expect that Mythic Quest, which is their first comedy, will also be coming out in January and maybe announced in the next week or so. If you actually look in the TV app, the Little America is still not in there yet. So currently, you continue to look inside the TV app, and your only thing coming soon is the Banker movie that remains to be seen whenever it's coming out or not. So that's the situation.
We should go see that in theaters together on it if it comes out.
Well, what's kind of funny is that the Hollywood Association that did the Golden Globes nominations, they were screened The Banker because that was, you know, this was going to be one of their award-winning...
It could have been considered, but...
Yeah, it could have been considered. And clearly it must have been, like, scrapped off the ballot paper or whatever when Apple, you know, it's no longer legible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it didn't actually...
It didn't actually come out.
Yeah. All right. Little America was interesting too because it was part of the March event last year where they showed talent from the show, and it was like one of that they brought out on stage and said that this is what will be part of this the service, and now they've got on their press site for TV Plus they've got an explainer about like what was it 8 episodes or so for mm-hmm. the first season. Like what each one will be about and the subject. And before we did the podcast, we were looking at the source material for the show, which is a series in Epic Magazine. You can go to epicmagazine.com/Little America, I think, to see everything. And it's interesting because it's like a visual of people and their stories from different parts of the world that came to America. And it's like laid out in the shape of America and like relative to where the states are, where they went to. And there are some interesting ones in there, but it seems like they changed some things up in the series. Like all the names are different and not all the subjects are covered and some we couldn't sort of put back together, but it's definitely different than what we've seen so far from TV Plus. You know, it's acted out, but it's based on events. Yeah.
So, and like Mythic Quest is something that the content library sorely needs in terms of just like raw comedy. Like as far as I can tell, Mythic Quest has no like, you know, story to tell or like, you know, message, you know, moral message about the world or anything. Like it's not going to be a show of depression. Right. Or drama. It's just, you know, it's closer to like Silicon Valley because it's about a video game studio, but it's a comedy. It's just like a straight comedy with like jokes.
I see.
It's like sitcom level. Yeah.
Yep. All right, and I guess that's it for TV Plus this week, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Apple TV Remote and TV Plus so far. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the new software releases that we get this week. So a bunch of software that's been in developer beta and public beta for the past few weeks, months, is finally out now. So hopefully the last beta software for the year until January comes around. But this includes iOS 13.3, tvOS 13.3, Catalina version 10.15.2, is that right? And then WatchOS 6.1?
Yeah, 6.1.1.
Yeah, catchy. 1.1, yeah. So all those are out now. And I, for one, have taken to all my devices and I've removed, I think to get to like the final release, you often have to remove the beta profile to get there anyway. But I went to every device and just got off the beta cycle. I don't know how long it'll last. It depends on like what's coming and, you know, 13.4, I guess.
Yeah, as soon as there's a competitive feature, you'll be right back on it.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. But it has been nice to know for once that I'm on the latest release software and nothing will be automatically installed on its own without me putting a profile back on. But let's talk a little bit about what's in each software update. I think they're all pretty minor, like nothing
huge. Yeah,
this is
definitely like the smallest point X of iOS 13.
So. Yeah, so like aside from the release notes, I would say that the best thing about all this stuff is probably what you can't see, the bug fixes and improvements, and just to say that iOS 13 is probably pretty solid now. Like this is probably as good as it gets now.
Yeah, realistically. Yeah. I mean, next year they're going to add iCloud folder sharing, so that'll be an interesting worm of problems maybe, but
that's true.
This could be the most stable iOS 13 release.
Yeah. So the first thing, which does have a bug in it, what we've learned
since we started
recording, is communication limits as part of screen time. And I think the idea here is that for the first time, you can do a few things. And the biggest thing is you can say after certain hours or just you've got a context database and only allow mom and dad or, you know, brother and sister to communicate, but not everyone in the contacts app. And that's a feature now. Didn't we see in this in the beta process? I don't think we ever got like further into testing it, but you could like remotely manage kids' contacts.
Yeah. So
did that make it?
Yeah. So the first part is exactly what you described, because before you could do downtime for like messages as the whole application. So you could say, you know, between the times of 9 and 7, you can use messages, but after 7 PM, you can't message anyone. Which is like, oh, okay, so you can't message your friends late into the night, but at the same time, you can't message someone important if you really need them, right? So communication limits lets you say you can talk to anyone during these hours and you can just talk to like VIPs and family in these hours. And then the second part is this kind of like contact list management, where as the parent, you can basically authorize or set it up so that your kids can't add contacts from strangers without you like approving it. So you force their contact list to basically be static, and then you have to say this person can be added, this person can be taken away. So if you just have a kid on their own, they can't just like go and start chatting with random people that you don't know if you don't let them, essentially.
Cool, yeah.
However, we have noticed it has come to light that there is a bug where this works fine on the iPhone, but you can be on the Apple Watch, and if you have a contact database that is not synced to iCloud, so if you use like Gmail contacts or something, the communication limits simply do not apply on the watch. You can just chat to whoever you want on the watch. So if you happen to be a kid with an Apple Watch, then you're getting communication limited, there's a workaround for you. Apple has said they're going to fix it, obviously, and their current solution for, you know, parents who are worried is to force people to use iCloud contacts. It was kind of funny that like messages on the watch is just so like isolated from the world. Like they still don't have proper integration for messages for iCloud. Clearly they have this bug which, you know, it isn't working properly, even though it works on the phone, doesn't work on the watch. And you said that you had a problem with unknown callers right on the watch with your...
Yeah. So my daughter just got the Apple Watch now. It was like a, you know, here's the thing to, you know, use. And she doesn't have the phone yet. She doesn't know she's got the phone coming for Christmas. And so by getting a new phone number with both the phone and the Apple Watch, then it's a recycled number. And so her phone number is on some calling list where she keeps getting a call from in the area. And she doesn't answer it. She ignores it. And she told me, someone keeps calling me. I don't know who it is, though, so I don't answer it. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I can fix that. And so what I did was I turned on the phone, don't allow calls that are not in your contacts, or only allow calls that are contacts, the iOS 13 feature. And it works great, you know, even if she's not near the phone, until the phone dies. And I'm not keeping the phone like charged or anything, because we're not using the phone at all. It's just like, you know, set up the watch at first, and then it's going to be a gift later. But as soon as the phone dies, then that feature goes away, because I guess it realizes it goes to the phone to work. And as far as the watch is concerned, the feature never came about. So, I just haven't put it on the watch itself yet.
That's
for some reason.
Stupid. Like, yeah, you know, silencing unknown callers does not require heavy computation. It's not running like machine learning models or anything. It's just, you know, is this contact in your database of people or recently contacted? Let it through. If not, don't. Like, it's just, right now it just all proxies through the phone. That just seems so stupid. But
yeah, the thing, I'm looking at this, the CNBC report, and it seems like if a new person texts you and then you can add it to your contacts, then that, I mean, it makes sense that these are like edge cases that they didn't tackle yet, but, and they're like functional bugs, I guess. But if someone new texts you, then you have the option to add them to your contact, and then they don't apply to that screen time limit, because the screen time limit, I guess, only sticks to the current contacts list. If you add it later, then it doesn't. So there's a lot of things that this. I mean, and it's funny that this came out later than the other features, because it was announced at WWDC.
Yep.
And then I guess they need to do more work on it to actually pull it off. But there seems to be some more work that they need to do. So they say they're going to fix it.
Screen time itself, which is obviously an iOS 12 feature, throughout, you know, iOS 12's lifetime, there were stories about kids finding workarounds for that kind of restrictions as well. Like, oh, you can't use the, you can't your messages app has been disabled. Oh, if you go to a share sheet of another app and press the messages share sheet extension, you can actually still message people in there. Like, loads of these like weird edge cases of the system that weren't just being respected properly for, you know, probably good reason. Like, it's hard to audit an entire operating system for every single way something can be triggered, right? Especially on the size of the iOS. And so and obviously over time Apple has followed up by, you know, patching those holes, and that sounds like what's happened here with communication limits. Again, people are just immediately finding, you know, edge case workarounds and ways to trick the system, and Apple will like follow up and fix it afterwards. Well, it is important to note that it's not like iOS 13.3 is introducing a new bug here, because before iOS 13.3,
it's like the feature is incomplete.
Yeah, you couldn't, before iOS 13.3, you couldn't have any restrictions over contact access. So now you have restrictions plus, you know, the edge cases that we need to
It's just
solved.
That the clever kids have found the workaround already.
In one day.
Yes, in one day. Yeah. And I guess that also tells us that there will be like a 13.3.1 or something coming before the end of the year, if they get around to fixing it before the end of the year. But hopefully they don't have to beta test that. And then for the TVS 13.3 release, we covered this story on 9 to 5 Mac whenever we first learned about it in the software, which was a few weeks ago. But it's the fact that now the Up Next feature for the Apple TV app can now be restored, versus the big splash screen of like what they want to promote for you on.
Yes, this
Apple
is
TV
on top
Plus.
Shelf on the home screen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is my favorite feature of all these updates. This cycle of updates. Like, I just hate the what to watch adverts are so annoying, and I intentionally made sure that our Apple TV in the house took the Apple TV app off the home screen row, because the adverts were too annoying to me.
Wow. Yeah.
So we've had, despite Apple TV Plus being a thing, I've demoted the TV app to the second row since TVS 13 came out. And now in 13.3, I will dive into the settings, I will flick it back to Up Next, and I will put it back on the top row again. Mm-hmm. Because it just saves you time, right? You can wake the Apple TV, you're on the home screen, you can look up above, oh, there's stuff that I'm watching right now, let's keep watching it. Whereas before it was like, here's this movie trailer for a movie that you don't own and you have to pay for. And so basically it's an advertisement.
Yeah, or in some cases a show you haven't seen yet but you want to watch, and so you don't want to have anything spoiled, or a show that you could watch that's included with your free subscription or paid subscription, but you just don't want to see it, and you know, here it is every time you navigate.
Yeah, and if you wanted to access your QSQ, it'd just be another button press. You have to press into the TV app, then look at the row, then scroll down, then click it. Whereas now you just look at the thing, you just scroll up, you flick what you want, you press play, and you're done. Like,
yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, I reverted it as soon as the option was available in beta, and I've got no thoughts about going back. So yeah. It's a good option, good change.
And then, we did talk about this on the show, but there's no in the beta period there was an option for music to do the same thing or for like arcade or whatever. And although those cases aren't as egregious as the TV situation because you have universal subscriptions versus, you know, content specific subscriptions, in the current shipping version there is no options for those apps either.
Yeah, I don't have those on the top shelf though.
So I have music on the top shelf. Because we actually play music through the Apple TV quite a lot. But the ads don't bother me as much, even though I did prefer the TV OS 12 way of doing it, which just showed you recently played albums. The music video stuff is fine because I could actually just click and watch the music video without having to pay anything extra. So it's less annoying. So the music app did not get demoted to the second row, but I would change it back if I was given the choice.
I think I've got, I've got Apple TV. I've got probably like Prime Video because it's included with your Prime Amazon Prime subscription. And then...
Photos?
No. I'm not a big photos user on the Apple TV because it's like my library, not anyone else's library. And I just like AirPlay the picture if I want to show it on the screen. But so Apple TV app, Prime Video, YouTube, Hulu. I don't do Hulu with live TV anymore, but just the basic Hulu with ads plan. And then we don't have Netflix, so we don't do Netflix on the top shelf. And I recently put the NASA app on the top shelf because I'm getting more into NASA stuff. And, you know,
nice.
So, yeah. So it's up there. So nothing with a big splash screen. You may have guessed that Benjamin is a developer, but I am not. But that doesn't mean my kids can't learn to code, thanks to Bitsbox. Bitsbox is an amazing service designed for kids aged 6 to 12 that sends you and your kids a special binder called the Apper Keeper, and inside you'll find easy-to-understand cards with fun subjects like animals and other characters. Bitsbox is a monthly subscription, so every month your child will receive new material for projects, and if your kids are like mine, they love to get mail of their own. Simply type in a 4-digit code on the Bitsbox website, then follow the instructions on the card for building fun and interactive apps that run on a virtual tablet in the web browser. Now, I can't stress enough that I am not a programmer, and I admit I was a bit intimidated when I thought about helping my daughter learn to code on her own, but Bitsbox makes learning to program extremely approachable with projects that are quick to complete and even physical stickers that your child can use to mark off completed projects in their Apper Keeper. And my daughter loves stickers, so it really is cool. All Bitsbox requires is a computer with a keyboard and the internet. Bitsbox notes that the coding part of the experience isn't meant to be done on tablets just yet, but you can totally play with the completed app on a phone or tablet after coding from a computer. And I'll share a tip here. My daughter has the new entry-level iPad and Apple Smart Keyboard. So I just had to test the new desktop class version of Safari on the iPad, and guess what? It totally works, exactly like on my Mac. In our experience, typing on the iPad Smart Keyboard was as easy as using my Mac, which I love. So if you're like me and want your kids to go even further than you with technology, Bitsbox is a fantastic way to get started and use iPads and Macs for more than just playing games and watching videos. Our listeners can get $25 off any Bitsbox subscription of $50 or more by going to bitsbox.com/happyhour and at checkout, enter promo code happyhour. That's $25 off plus free shipping at bitsbox.com/happyhour and use code happyhour for this exclusive offer. Order Bitsbox today. Your kids will love coding and you'll gift them with an important skill that's necessary for a successful future. You noticed a change, I guess it was from the release notes that you were curious about, which is that some content in News Plus has been changed. I think there's changes to how you use the app, like that you can... There's like buttons on the screen without having to like tap through to see it, buttons for like navigating around that makes it
more
user-friendly. They've added
back like buttons that were there before, then they got rid of them and now they're back again. So you get thumbs up and thumbs down buttons that you can like and dislike with one tap.
Yeah.
And then what was described in the release notes was new layouts for leading newspapers in Apple News Plus, like the Wall Street Journal. And I love any time they have an update to News Plus. I can't wait to see what they've done with it, because it's just like, yeah, it's just the thing that's like, you know, a complete, not failure, but it's not doing great. The app was terrible from the beginning. And they have had pretty regular update, small minor changes in basically every release of the operating system to, you know, address it. So I love seeing, you know, what they cooked up this time. And the changes are indeed very, very minor. The way the newspapers are displayed in the feed has been tweaked. So they use serif fonts now, so they stand out a bit more as like newspaper content. And there's a slight different layout to the categories. But when you actually tap through to the stories, the story feed is like the same. So it's only when you're like looking at the news feed, essentially, of all the stuff joined together. But when you go through to the actual stories themselves, they're unchanged, which is what the release notes are a bit ambiguous about what it was talking about. It's talking about just the home screen feed. So it's a nice improvement, but, you know, it's still very, 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 very minor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty. It makes sense that it looks more like newspapers, and it's like visually a style that says what it is. So I like that about it. But yeah, I don't think I would have noticed otherwise without you hunting it down.
It's certainly not a thing that would change the value equation of the News Plus subscription.
Yeah. What about in general the Apple News app? Do you use the Apple News app regularly?
You know what?
Do you have it on your home screen or your dock or anything?
I do have it on my home screen.
Okay.
I use it less more recently because now they started stuffing it with advertising for Apple News Plus.
Okay.
Which is making me hate it more. I do like the top stories that they do. I do have breaking news notifications on from the News Plus editors thing.
Okay.
But I have not subscribed to News Plus. Obviously, News Plus in the UK only launched in like September. I still have my free trial yet to redeem. I don't know when I want to redeem it or if I ever will. It depends on, you know, the situation with the app, especially being pretty rough and the content there just not being like, the problem for me is, you know, my news content, I just read BBC news like all the time, and most of the stuff that's recommended to me in the news app is just BBC content and like some other newspapers that are all free and just have ads. So that's what I read, that's what I use it for. I don't check it like as religiously as like Twitter, right? Maybe like once a day I'll like open the news thing, go on the front page and like scroll around a little bit and see some stories, but now more recently they start putting like a full screen advertisement for like the four top magazines. And it's like, look, I don't mind a little bit of News Plus like thing, but it's quite, it's becoming more and more overbearing in the free, and because they have a separate tab for News Plus, right? But that hasn't stopped them from injecting the main Today feed with some News Plus ads.
Yeah. I like for News Plus specifically, I've been like in and out of trying it out, like not just the free trial, but actually like paying for it for a month here and there. And I've not gotten yet to where it's like with iCloud or Apple Music, where I just don't even think about it. I just pay for it. But often what will happen is I'll go and cancel it, and then I'll like check out the news app again, and I'll realize, oh, there's still some stuff here from like the, I guess, being paid for. I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. Let me click on that, you know. I just haven't made a habit about going to the app and looking for things. But it's a little bit complicated for me. So like, as you know, editors, like we look for news for 9to5 Mac, and we want to know like everything that's going on, and then like pick from all of that to see what we want to cover for, you know, on the site. And so we've got to have like this humongous look what's going on. So our Twitter accounts need to be like, you know, tuned to follow the right stuff and not miss anything. And I don't know about you, but I often, well, not every day, but I'll use RSS whenever I'm really looking for something that I haven't found something, you know.
Yeah, like checking my RSS feed is like my primary way of finding stories for work, essentially.
Like, yeah, it's like what has everyone that I care about published, you know.
And yeah, I'm through that. My Apple News usage is not like for like tech news, right? Because I get it through Twitter and RSS. My Apple News is like, you know, just general what's going on in the world, that kind of
thing. And I don't use RSS for like the general stuff, but I do use Twitter for that because I do like to like see stuff as it's happening and like developing. And there used to be a few good apps for that. Like the best one, I think it was like funded by NBC News, but it wasn't just NBC News, and it was called Breaking News. And you could have push alerts for things that were truly breaking news, not just like trending or what things they wanted to push and promote, but like a breaking news story from any source that they thought was you know worth sending you a push alert for. And that went away because I guess there wasn't a model there to make it work. But it was just too bad because nothing's replaced yet since For Me. That it's not just news from one source or, you know, too general. But then there's the app Nuzzle. I don't know if you've used that, but
I haven't used it, but I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, it integrates with your Twitter account or Facebook or both, and it uses what the people who you follow on Twitter and the links that they've shared to send you a push notification. So if a bunch of people are tweeting out the same link, then Nuzzle can notice that and then send you a push notification for it. And I think the trick there is that you've got to really set the threshold high, otherwise you just get alerts throughout the day. And it's, for me, it's only useful on like weekends or hours that I'm not like actually looking at the Twitter stream, because so much of it is like, I've got to find something that works for me without being overkill, you know, so, cause I'm only watching the timeline of like things as they unfold. And with Breaking News, it went away. With Nuzzle, I haven't quite gotten to a point where I'm using it all the time because I still feel like it's too much or it's not enough. And they've done a bunch of other things besides just that one feature that I don't care for. But with Apple News, I think part of the problem is, you know, they got the whole following feature where you can go through and like hunt for sources that you care about and like have that populate into the algorithm of what you like. And I've tried to do that with like non-tech news, you know, and they've got their own section for like what they're promoting like editorially as well. And I think I like that more than like the frame, you know, design it yourself sort of thing, because, you know, it can't be so if you've seen online, I guess, if you follow those sites on Twitter or something. But I just haven't gotten to a point where it's like I look at it and I'm like, there's a bunch of stuff here for me to look at and get something from, you know, so. I don't know. I'm still kind of like, I know a lot of people love it, and like it's like their main way to look into the news of what's happening. Like you haven't set up a Twitter account and you don't know what RSS is, and like Apple News is a good product in that situation. But for me, I've not yet found it, but I haven't rolled it out either. Like I put it on my home screen every now and then, or on my Mac dock every now and then. I just haven't made a habit of like when to look at it and get stuff from it that I don't already know about or just don't care about.
Yeah, I'm not using any of the, like, you follow the channels that you want to see. I'm basically just going on the Today feed to see their editorial stuff, because they do, at least for the UK, I feel like they do a pretty good job of like spanning the world's the country's important news, and then you can see like trending and stuff. So that's kind of like where I get the value out of it. It's literally like the human editorial. I guess it's just the equivalent of a newspaper that, you know, I don't have to pay for, I guess. And it links to stories with ads in it, which is fine, whatever, you know. 95 Mac is an ad-supported site. I don't have problems with web ads.
It's more like a big like newsletter where it's stuff from different sources, but it's curated and like, you know, just what they think you'll care about.
Yeah, do you know what? Yeah. Recently, Apple's actually launched.
This is accidental, but yes.
A good morning email newsletter. They, for Apple News specifically, I presume this is part of their like Apple News Plus marketing push, because they've had a sign up to get email alerts from Apple News for a long time, I think since the app came out, but they've only used it like very fleetingly to send like, you know, top picks and stuff, and it wasn't regular. And now in the last couple of weeks, they've actually launched they're rolling out a daily newsletter. So every single morning, you can get the top stories of the day plus some like features from Apple News Plus and, you know, some quotes and stuff with, and then the picks of the news, they're not just like links. They also have like human written descriptions and summaries of the content that's inside them, written by like real people, not, you know, algorithmic. It's still a bit unclear to me what the status of the newsletter is, because definitely some people are on it, but like say if I'm just a layman standing right here, how do I sign up for the newsletter? I can't find a way to do it. It doesn't. I've clicked all the boxes in like Apple ID settings, and I have not received a single email about news. Maybe it's because I'm in the UK and it's only launching in the US. I don't know. But you can't like go into the Apple News app and see like a setting for email options and then daily newsletter, get it or not get it. It's just in the last couple of weeks, some people have started really getting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Marketing for News Plus in a way, because they had the top stories and they showed like a featured magazine article from Apple News Plus and then some other stuff below it. I think it's cool that they're offering it. Some people like that stuff, you know. Email newsletters have kind of had like a resurgence in popularity in the last like 5 years in terms of like paid newsletters and membership newsletters and just, you know, general newsletters. And so, you know, Apple's joining the throng.
Yep. That's another thing, like newsletters for me. If I could create my own newsletter of that topic, then like someone else's doesn't really interest me. But I am sort of discovering, like, if there's something that I wanted that I couldn't make on my own, or I don't want to go through the trouble of like looking for it on my own, then someone else's newsletter in that category can be a service to me. So I kind of get it. With the Apple News one, I haven't signed up for it or like hunted it down myself yet. I did see, you know, whenever we were covering the story, like, oh, that's what it is. But it's kind of compelling to me because I've done those sort of like morning digests. This is what you missed overnight, or like this is the big stuff from yesterday, or like what to pay attention for today. Stories and newsletters, and if it's from one publication, then it's just to that one publication for me. You know, and I guess the appeal of the News Plus one is that it's curated of so many different sources. So it's a good idea, and it's fitting for the sort of moment that we're in where people are really enjoying those. So yeah, maybe one of us will get it, and we can see what it's all about. There's also some new stuff in Apple News this week that we learned just today, which is that in February, Apple will co-sponsor a Democratic debate. So this is in the presidential Democratic primary sort of like campaign cycle where throughout the country, voters are picking who will be the Democratic nominee to run for president and to be up for election in November. First, they've got to pick the person who will be that one person among, you know, 20 or so people. And this will be one of the debates. And it's a first. Twitter's also doing something like this, too, for a different debate. So each one of those things could be a little bit different. But historically, it's been newspapers and news organizations sponsor these things. They put them on. They've got some involvement in the production and advertisement and picking the questions and even, like, supplying the moderators. In this case, it's kind of a big unknown what will happen with a Twitter co-sponsored debate, an Apple co-sponsored debate. But they do say specifically it's Apple News, not just like Apple in general. So it's got a more of a purpose there. And then that it could be, you know, Apple's got a whole organization of like news veterans that do the human curation of what you get in the Apple News app. You know, they pick what to highlight, and they sometimes even like write their own editorial around the content, you know, and they've done those guys like they done the presidential, you know, I think in 2016 they did a part of it, and in this cycle they're doing even more where they create content to show you, to inform you. So
yeah, if I open the Apple News app right now, I have a whole dedicated section for the UK election, which is, you know, hand curated and written up, mm-hmm. and they have all the different candidates and everything. It's all,
yeah.
It's all
there. And the pull on resources like illustrations from other people, you know, but they paid for it just for this feature. So we don't know what to expect yet. This is in February, and usually you don't learn about the format and everything until like right before, you know, because there's so many of these and they're all kind of in flux. But in this situation, it could be like Apple has an editor-in-chief, Lauren Kern, who's from, you know, the news and magazine world and you know, actually like working in the industry as sort of like leading groups like this. So it could be that her and her team have involvement in picking the questions they think are important for the debate, like to frame what the debate is like. And that, you know, by co-sponsoring the debate, you know, they help with the production of it and make it possible. It could be that they even supply someone to moderate and like literally ask the questions, but that would be kind of wild. Like it wouldn't be Tim Cook. Like I joked on Twitter, you know, please let it be Eddie Q. But like the closest thing I could see like actually happening is like Lauren Kern, the editor in chief of Apple News, is one of the people, you know, and a lot of times if it's like a co-sponsor or something, then they'll only ask a few questions in like one segment and not be the main anchors and moderators of the debate. But you know, so it's kind of a big question there. But, you know, I guess what we'll see is how much is Apple involved as a co-sponsor? Are they just sort of producing it and supplying, you know, resources and you know, that relationship? Or are they involved in the questions and they kind of sort of pick, like, among all the questions, what are we going to include in this one? Do we include somebody? Do we promote this single debate heavily in the Apple News app and offer our own like live stream of it through the app without, because also with the debates, like if they're co-sponsored by a network, then they're only available on that network. And so it might be like a TV station and the newspaper. And so you can view on TV on that station or on the newspaper's website sort of thing. So surely they will live stream this through the news app or the TV app or something, but we don't know yet because it's
far off. Yeah, because that's what I thought when I saw the headline. I was like, okay, they're not going to actually like, they're not going to send someone, but they'll probably have advertising and they would stream it inside the news app because they certainly haven't shied away from doing like political coverage. They've, you know, they had all the nominees with little like, they even had like cartoons drawn up of everyone's people and descriptions in their biographies and stuff as the, you know, the Democratic race went on. And they've partnered with like NBC before for like news clips and video highlights and stuff, but they haven't actually like live streamed a debate of any kind yet. So the fact that they're now moving up from, you know, to, just doing something on their own to like actually, you know, actively partnering with the production of it, it seems to me like surely this has to be like a video stream kind of deal.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering how much branding we see from for Apple News on screen during the debate. You know, if it's just a mention here and there, or if there's like, you know, visual elements of it at all times. Like I think a lot of times the backdrop is like the co-sponsors. You know, so that'll be different and interesting to see. A lot of people that I've seen react to the story are uncomfortable with Apple being this involved in politics. It gets part of the process of politics to have debates, and for Apple to be involved in any way is it's just uncomfortable. And part of it, like you mentioned before, they had the big thing with the candidate profiles. And it's like, well, you did those for the Democrats, but you didn't do them for the Republicans. But there's no primary for Republicans right now because the incumbent is Donald Trump, and he's no one ran against him in a way that that made a primary. So it's awkwardly timed to be just one party. But they did do some general election stuff in 2016. That was you know, sort of even sighted. And in this case, there's just not the opportunity. But once you get to the general election cycle, you know, beyond the summer, then if this is a success for Apple and they like what happened with it, then maybe we'd see the same thing with the general election. And, you know, obviously in the future, when there is a Republican primary or whatever party, then they've got the experience to pull off the same thing. And it's not just because it's one party or the other right now. And also like, what I would add to that is that they've done similar things for other topics like the Olympics, for example. They did a bunch of editorial stuff for the Olympics.
Yeah.
And that's a friendlier thing to do, you know, sort of exercise that muscle of being, you know, an actual news group and deciding how to cover this stuff through the service and add, you know, contribute to what you're, you know, showing and picking from. And it makes sense. It's like if you want to have a bigger splash than just being a curator, that doesn't add any value to it. And the only value is in picking what to show. You know, you want to stand out and be big, more than that. I think it does make sense to have these like news veterans do news things. And it just so happens that, you know, at the time the Olympics were big, the election, like that's the main thing that the news cycle, you know, national news cycle is about right now. It's going to be this year. So it would be, if they're going to do this at all, then I think it would just be awkward to ignore election stuff. And so, you know, if you don't like it, just don't pay attention to it. But I think it's okay for Apple to be doing. And it's and using the Apple News branding and that separation, I think it is appropriate as well. You know, not to say this is the Apple debate, but it's the Apple News co-sponsored debate.
Yeah, like you have to face it. Apple's doing more and more with content, right? And
yes,
they, you know, they're not. They're not like running away from only doing like soft subjects. They're covering, you know, deep things that are causing them controversies all across the board, whether you're talking about like, should they be involved in politics or should they, you know, be releasing a film that has allegations against, you know, the son of the subject of the film, like all of that stuff. It's just wrapped up into like Apple's doing content in original content in a bigger way than ever before. And, you know, you're just gonna have to lump it. They're doing it. They seem to be happy to embrace it.
Yeah, I mean, we tackled this topic whenever they had the profiles of candidates a few months ago, which is, what do they do when the issues are about Apple, you know? And they tackled it right on with Elizabeth Warren's profile, where it was like, you know, policy is about breaking up big tech companies, including Apple.
Yeah, they, don't, like, they do seem to be doing a good job at being impartial.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and it's because it's not just Apple employees who have always been like, Apple employees from the start, and you know, they you know, they bleed six colors, and it's like they are the Apple people, but it's people from the news world who are now employed by Apple to do news things. And, you know, Facebook has their own version of this. Other companies have their own version of this. It's another thing where if everyone's going to be doing it, Apple can make a contribution here that can hopefully be handled better than other companies. So I'm not bothered by it. And I don't tune into every debate now, but this one, you know, because of the Apple connection, I will, you know, just see how it goes and what their involvement is.
And then finally, in the kind of like software update realm, not an official feature, but we found code references to Powerbeats 4.
Yeah, so not Powerbeats Pro, but Powerbeats 4. Which, if you recall the Powerbeats Pro, like before we had that name down, there was a CNET story that was about some of the features that would be included. And my first guess was, oh, Powerbeats 4, you know. And then it ended up being a much bigger deal, and it was Powerbeats Pro, which we found, and like how they look and everything. But Powerbeats 4, that suggests it's not the redesign like Powerbeats Pro that are truly wireless, but it's a new version of Powerbeats 3 wireless. But with new features like AirPods 1 to AirPods 2.
Siri support.
Yeah, yeah. So probably you go from the H1 chip or the W1 chip to the H1 chip. That's the progression. Just like from AirPods 1 to AirPods 2. And then you get the voice recognition stuff. You get the better experience with gaming and switching phone calls and connections and everything. And that's your product. So, which is there a connection there with audio sharing and announce messages with Siri that also tied to the chip?
Those
are also H1 or
they're all H1.
W1.
Yeah.
So okay, well, new product. Maybe they get better battery life. I don't know, but it at least tells us that they're not going to only have the Powerbeats Pro at $250, and they'll continue making something that's cheaper. You know, even if it isn't as sleek and nice.
They're giving the Powerbeats more updates than they give the iPod Touch. Which is like the, you know, Powerbeats Pro is like iPod Touch to iPhone, you know what I mean?
It's like, yeah.
They nurture the lower end of the Beats line for sure when they don't with some of their iDevices. Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Text Expander is an incredible Mac productivity tool to have in your arsenal. Make everything you write repetitively available everywhere you type. Text documents, spreadsheets, web forms, and more. Turn the things you type into reusable snippets to access them time and time again. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. With variables and forms, snippets are much more powerful. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual message. Text Expander is applicable to so many situations, email addresses, signatures, chunks of code, form letters, anywhere that you need consistent and accurate text. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. Don't reinvent common email and message replies every time you need them. Store them in Text Expander. It's available for macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. And for Mac users upgrading to Catalina, don't sweat, Text Expander is ready and working and ready to go for you. Text Expander for Teams adds a whole extra layer for coordinating work with others. Snippets can be shared automatically across the organization. You can manage which members of your team have access to different snippets with Text Expander groups. And you can even see statistics about which snippets are being used more than others, so you can focus on tuning up any areas that are being ignored. Companies use Text Expander for Teams for things like customer support, reporting, and so much more. Shared snippets unify your organization's voice. Unlock your productivity with Text Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
All right, Mayo, finally on the 9 to 5 Mac podcast, Happy Hour podcast, let's talk about the Mac specifically. It is Mac Pro week in terms of being able to buy some. So what's here? That you can order the Mac Pro, you can spec it out to like the fullest it can be. You can do the same thing for the Apple Pro Display XDR. did we learn anything this week? Are there any like new questions that we've got or questions answered? What's going on here?
Yeah, like me and you, we're not in the market for this tower, really.
Well, speak
like,
for yourself. Just kidding. No.
If you want a deep dive into, you know, Mac Pro configurations, then there are plenty of other podcasts you can listen to. Like, for me, the Mac Pro is a great thing for Apple to have available for the people that want it. Like, obviously, you know, everyone's going to do the stories. Oh, you can spec the Mac Pro up to $52,000 when you max out every single thing with 1.5 terabytes of RAM and, you know, just going all out. And very few people are actually in the market for that configuration. But there are people that are, and those people are often, like it or not, like influential in the creative space, like the top end video producers and filmmakers and photo editors and all of that stuff. Like before now, they were not being well served by the 2013 Mac Pro. And now with the 2019 Mac Pro, which might as well be the 2020 Mac Pro because it's, you know, just squeaking in there before the end of the year, there is actually, you know, if you need a Mac that has 768 gigs of RAM, you can get one. If you need a Mac that's 1.5 terabytes of RAM, you can get one, and you couldn't do it before. And it clearly, the Mac Pro addresses complaints of the 2013 revision. What I don't think it does is offer a nice computer for professionals that are software developers, like me. The iMac Pro just seems like a much better solution for almost everyone in that regard. It's much better priced, for given the specs you get. Like it seems incredibly punitive to me that the base model $6,000 Mac Pro has a 256 gig SSD when the iMac Pro is a terabyte, and the MacBook Pro starts at 512, and that MacBook Pro starts like 2300. It's just insane. Like the Mac Pro, there was a funny tweet that I saw that was like, the Mac Pro is made for like celebrities and NASA. And it's kind of true, right? Like it's, you know, the people that need that much RAM and that many cores are doing like huge data modeling, you know, big machine learning stuff, models. If you go to Apple's campus in a year's time, and you know, in the Apple Park is full of people that are writing software all day long, compiling software, shipping it out the door. I highly doubt that they'll be using Mac Pros that much. I think they're going to pick iMac Pros or laptops. Like, the developer lifestyle heavily favors towards iMacs, like high-end iMacs and laptop computers like MacBook Pros. It just is. And it's funny because when they did the Mac Roundtable 2 years ago now, or however long ago it was, they said the biggest market of professionals for them are developers. But I would very much argue that this Mac Pro is not aimed at the developer market. It's definitely more aimed at the creative professionals with video and photos, and that's why they spent the time to engineer the Afterburner card, which can speed up ProRes encodings. That's why this thing has like the MPX custom modules for graphics cards, and you can have like four graphics cards in two across two modules because you have the duo configurations. That all those things that make it like great for photos and videos and that kind of stuff. And big data modeling, because big data stuff requires lots of GPUs. Normally, machine learning models run on GPUs predominantly. All that stuff has very little appeal and is essentially wasted on like the mass developer community. Like, if you're a developer, I 100% think you'd be looking at iMac Pros predominantly. It's going to be rare that you're like, maybe you'd want a Mac Pro if it wasn't like, if price was no object and stuff. But if you just look at the lineup, the iMac Pro is a much better choice. And I'm not like resenting Apple for making a product that's designed to like whittle in photo professionals, but I think that the Mac Pro configurations as they are could have been cheaper and different to better support like that user base.
No, I mean, there's definitely a hole in the lineup right now that the Mac Pro hasn't resolved. I mean, just look at the display alone, the 32-inch Apple Pro Display XDR that's 6K. you know, it's amazing from the front, and then from like the sides and the back, it makes compromises that you wouldn't necessarily expect in an Apple display if it were for anything else than the Mac Pro, like, you know. So we all want something that as a display to use with the Mac Mini, or a second display for the iMac that looks like the iMac, or, you know, a display that's designed as nice as the MacBook Pro to use with the MacBook Pro. And this could have been that, but it's not. And there's still so much room for that. You know, they're still relying on LG for the best displays with like macOS integration that you can get right now. And to have, you know, something that's $5,000+ be that solution, it's might as well not even exist for people like me and you. And for a lot of people, I mean, this is, you might not, you just don't need that. And it is a thing where, you know, it's always interesting to learn about how people are using their devices, whether it's the Apple Watch or, you know, the iPhone and the iPad or the Mac, and like how are people actually applying the technology and, like, you know, improving their lives with it. And I will be very curious with the Mac Pro, like, to see their stories of like how people are using it. There's been some stuff like the Mac Power Users podcast had a guest on that Apple supplied who was seated early with a Mac Pro to use in an editing studio for video. And it's someone who's made ads for Apple before and music videos and different things. And like their description of the configuration that they got, which was like not the base model, but not the highest end model. They were able to, with a straight face, describe it as sort of a mid model, middle of the road model. And whereas like me, I would call like any Mac Pro model super high end or like super high end. Like, you know, I couldn't with a straight face like call it. It's not the best, not the worst, but it's in the middle there.
I'd call the base model a bad model because you can always you can get better configurations in the iMac Pro or the laptops, basically.
Right. But to call something that's much higher than the base model, you know, middle of the road model, that kind of gives you perspective of like how they're using it and what they can get out of it.
Yeah, because like each upgrade on the configure page, you know, you don't have to go. You can basically just add a laptop on for every upgrade. Like, you want the better graphics card, that's $1,000. You want 96 gigs of memory, that's $1,000. You want 2 terabytes of storage, that's $800. Like, everything on the configure page is like, you know, you could have bought a MacBook Air, but no, you're going to upgrade this one spec of this tower computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way they describe like that there would be a new scenario of like work projects that they could take on because they had the Mac Pro in their rotation. And it was kind of an edge case. It was kind of a thing where they were taking someone who wanted to work with film, but then have it edited. It was like, would have been way too intensive on other computers, including the iMac Pro. But because of the Mac Pro, they have a tool that can handle what it takes to do that. You know, and that's interesting. It's also interesting hearing like how much faster the same task can be if you're using this new stuff and you've got, you know, this high end needs. But I hope to hear a lot more of these stories of like how people are using it in ways that are more than just like, that's a really cool thing, you know, and I want it. But, the practical, the benefits that come from it, even like the big data stuff, like how people will use the, like server version, you know, and things that only the Mac Pro could do, where it's not just do something better, but like do something at all as possible. You know, like where does that massive amount of RAM come in handy? Like hearing those things is will be interesting.
Yeah, like the tower form factor, I am not envious of at all. Like you talked to me about expandability and portability and expandability and like flexibility and massive graphic card arrays. You know, it's falling on deaf ears for me. Like it's, I think the iMac Pro is a much better form of a computer if I was going for a desktop, and my preference is towards laptops. So even if you drop like 10 grand on my desk and said you have to spend this on Mac stuff, I wouldn't be buying the Mac Pro. I would probably be buying like an iMac Pro. But the Pro Display XDR, you know, I do kind of want one, even though it's too expensive that I'm not going to buy one, right? Like,
yeah.
I care about rich image quality, even though I'm not editing photos and stuff. I'm, you know, typing text most of the time. But when I'm watching videos or you know, doing light photo editing in my own photo library, I'd love to have, you know, a 1600 nit display with incredible contrast and beautiful color and like, and in the body. I think the Pro Display XDR, despite having to have such compromises for, you know,
on the backside,
peak brightness, I still think it looks really good. Like, it looks way prettier than the LG UltraFine display, even with the fact that it has to be really thick and chunky because of the fan situation and the cooling. the Pro Display XDR, if someone dropped 10 grand on my desk and was like, you have to spend this on the Apple Store today on the Mac stuff, you know, I'd be buying a display. Like, that thing is cool. And I'd probably get the Nano T-shirt. And then you'd have to pay the $1,000 extra as well to get the cool stand with it, because how can you not? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
What I want, and we've said this before, I'll say it again, make a Pro Display XDR that's not XDR, that's like 50% as good, yeah, so it can come within a reasonable price bracket that includes a stand in the same package, and just make it, you can make it thin if you want to, you can round the edges, you can put a webcam in, which the Pro Display XDR does not have, because apparently in edit suites people don't like webcams, so they didn't include one, and just, you know, maybe add a Face ID camera as well if you want to be like really consumery, more down to earth, and that is like a display that anyone can love, developers would love it, even like non super serious photo editors would love it, because up to now, everyone's got by with the IMAX screens that are also really, really nice. And the IMAX screens today aren't XDR. So it's not like you have to have an XDR display to edit pictures. It's just nice to have one if you can get one. But as nice as it is, I couldn't justify spending, you know, $6,000 on it today.
Mm, yeah.
But it is really cool.
Yeah, I think like in bad spending for the sake of cool tech, for me, like $3,000 is kind of the limit there.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I did the iMac Pro for refurbished for under 4,500, you know, the 5,000 mark was like kind of cutting it close there. Refurbished made more sense in terms of like stomachability. But just for the display alone, it'd be more than the iMac Pro. It's like, oh, I couldn't even dream of that.
Yeah. And again, these prices are easily in the realm of professional photographers and videographers, yeah, because the cameras that YouTubers buy are like $8,000 minimum, $10,000 minimum, mm-hmm, right? I think like Marcus Brownlee buys cameras like $50,000, $80,000. Like, mm-hmm, you know, that's fine. That's their industry. And that's why the prices are not insane for the industry that this product is targeted at. But when you're looking at it from, you know, the high end consumer side of the spectrum, which is basically where we are, it just looks ridiculous, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can go, well, if the product's not for you, you can't complain about the pricing. I think that's wrong. Like, the base model of the Mac Pro is overpriced and under-spec. You can either make it cheaper or you can put better specs in. I don't care which way you go on it. You can complain about that even if you're not in the market for one. Clearly, I keep complaining about Twitter about the 256 gig SSD in it. Everyone keeps replying to me, oh, but it's for people that just only use cloud apps and they just want to put it on a network with network attached storage. I don't care. The iMac Pro is also using this exact same context. It has a terabyte of RAM in it as standard. They're just being cheap. Simple as that. Mm. Rant over.
Well, I did like the it was the popular mechanics coverage of the, mm-hmm, Mac Pro that included a few folks from Apple, and it was mainly to focus on, you know, the design of this thing, and it's not silent, but it's you know, it has an interesting design that doesn't include filters, but does include fans and very intentional designs. And I thought that was neat. And that's kind of like where my Mac Pro interest is in, like, it's the design isn't like, you know, they didn't do like with the 2013 Mac Pro where they say, you know, we're going to change what a tower computer is. And it was really cool. It's like, you can take off the lid and access everything or at least see it. They went back to what worked before, you know, a traditional tower format, but they were still able to do things in the design that makes it just very nice to look at and see. And like, it would be awesome to own one of these things, but not in its like launch period where it costs, you know, what it cost. Like, it wouldn't be terrible if this same like casing and everything with the same customization just had like lower end. You know, you can't go lower than the storage, but just you know, more consumery options. And I don't know if that
chip instead of a Xeon, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if that would even be popular. Like, the form factor is kind of a restraint for a lot of consumer needs. You know, it needs to be like in a data center or like your studio where you edit all, you know, with your company, and not, you know, in a home office or like portability and everything like a laptop. But I mean, like, as a piece of technology and like a machine, It's very much an Apple product. Like, you know, they took, like they did with the previous Mac Pro, you know, took a category and made it nice. But also this Mac Pro does sort of target a higher end starting point than the previous Mac Pros have. You know, it's much more than the price, and you know, and they go from a display that costs like, what, $1,200 or so to, you know, $5,000, $6,000. So yeah, it's a whole other beast. But I do hope that over time we see some things that they've done here. You know, this is, I don't think they had to, you know, people have been saying this is nice, but let's make sure we get annual updates. The fact that you can configure so much of it after the fact yourself kind of lessens the need for that. You know, like this can be the Mac Pro for a while. It's the iMac Pro now that's starting to be aged, you know, where it can't even drive the Pro Display XDR because of the Thunderbolt controller inside. And like you can actually do it from a small iMac and a, you know, Mac laptop, but not the iMac Pro because of its age. Like it's 2 years old now. That's the kind of thing where I hope now that they're finished with this project and it's shipping and this is like it for a while, you know, configure it on your own later, then we can start seeing some of the stuff that they've done here, like create a display, you know, for the first time in years. Bring that to the consumer market too, you know, and make improvements to the iMac Pro. Or, you know, something I could see is just like there doesn't have to be an iMac Pro and an iMac. There could just be the iMac, and it's space gray or it's silver or space gray, you pick. But it's all SSD, or you just keep taking the iMac. You know, you spec it out higher and higher, and you get the option of like i7, i9, Xeon. It doesn't have to be its own separate thing. And that whole thermal system from the iMac Pro, like that could just be what the iMacs are. Yeah. You know,
it's not like that. Some special diversion that has to, it's not like a separate train of components, right? It's just this is the better thermal design that that for price reasons they can't afford to put in the cheap iMacs yet.
Yeah, and you can spec up an iMac now to where it just makes more sense to buy that than the base model iMac. And the further along we get along that route, it's like those, you know, maybe they should just be one line, and like you don't have to put Pro in the name. It's just, you know, you just spend a lot more money and you get a lot better, you know, specs. So I hope we see something there. It would be a shame for it to be like two lines that you maintain on very different schedules. You know, or that the iMac Pro for 5,000 plus is what keeps getting innovated and pushed forward, but the iMac doesn't, you know, because that's the consumer product. And we you know, bring what you've done with the iMac Pro now to the iMac in more ways than you have, and maybe even just make it one line, you know, and have like Pro configurations of it, but not be a separate thing. That would be nice. But I do feel good about the Mac Pro is out now, the display is out now. And it seems to be what's been keeping them busy for a long time in other areas. Like they've done MacBook work. The 16-inch is nice. I'm happy it's here. It satisfies my need for like a new, you know, shiny computer from Apple. But I do feel like the Mac Pro has been keeping them busy for a few years now, and that's taken attention away from other desktop Macs. And maybe it'll be better next year.
Yeah, we've heard rumors about like mini LED displays for iMacs and stuff and laptops. So. Maybe that's what's coming down the pipe, because that'd be cool.
And we're still waiting. Remember the Ming-Chi Kuo report that was like a new iMac with the display technology?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, then we got the MacBook with True Tone. We never got that Mac.
Oh, and by the way, everyone keeps saying like, oh, we're going to put nanotexture is going to get cheaper and be put on like laptops. We had this week a story where it's like, Apple says you cannot clean this thing unless you use this exact brand of cleaning cloth that we provide you. Like, clearly... It is a fragile material that costs a lot of money to do. It's an expensive process, $1,000 upgrade. Like, nanotexture is not going to come down the line anytime soon. It is meant for very specific situations, and most people are perfectly happy with glossy panels.
Now, it's there are cheaper ways to do a matte finish that isn't. Is nice, but they get the job done, and that could always have been an option. I mean, it used to be for MacBooks. So.
Yeah, and they took it away because clearly it wasn't very popular.
Right. Yep. Away from the Mac now, a few more things to talk about this week. First with the Apple Watch is that the Gym Orange Theory Fitness, which is like they're popular in the U.S. There's not one close enough for me to be an option. But there's one like 45 minutes away. But I hear from people who go and they have a good time, and it seems to be like when you go to this fitness club, then you want to keep going back, and it's very motivational. Not just like anyone can come, but anyone can come. But you get a lot out of your membership, and it's motivational. They've announced a new hardware accessory called the OT Beat Link. So Orange Theory Beat Link. And it's a $130 accessory that attaches to the band of your Apple Watch. So you can use your Apple Watch heart rate monitor with the machine that you're doing, or to give credit for the workout that you're in. And it's interesting. It's like, I don't know enough about Orange Theory Fitness and like what the workouts are to know if this is just a cheaper way to deploy what gym kit could do. I think that's definitely the case for like the machines, you know, like the treadmill and the bikes. But maybe it's also true that they do things in other workout scenarios where gym kit wouldn't be an option. And so far what they've done is you bring your own Orange Theory compatible heart rate tracker that contributes to the system that you're in. I think that's the case. It's just a shame that you couldn't just take data from the Apple Watch itself and then share that you've got to attach this device to it that you've also got to charge. And it's kind of clunky. So it's cool that Orange Theory did it. And it's not like a random thing that they did. Like, they worked with Apple on this, it seems. And Apple had some comment in the press release. Yeah, that was positive. But it's not very sleek or anything.
It's kind of like, it's hard to work out why this couldn't have just been done in software, because the watch kit APIs, the watch OS APIs let you access real-time heart rate readings. The watch has Bluetooth. You think that would be enough to connect to the gym equipment? Like, I don't quite understand what the $129 peripheral that also needs to be regularly charged actually is required for, but that's how they're going with it.
Yeah, and it reminds me of last week whenever Peloton released their Apple Watch app for Peloton Digital, and its main focus is for showing you metrics from indoor runs or something with heart rate, but you've got to start the workout from your iPhone and not from the bike that's like the main product or other methods. So, and for me, I always begin the workout from the watch and just do the workout on the Peloton bike separately. And what people want, like what I want, is for there to be, they have a watch app that you can load the outdoor guided runs, like instructional runs, on the watch itself that you can then play back or stream without having to bring the iPhone, and then all that syncs up. But they don't do that yet. It's just something a little bit different that, for me, I can kind of ignore because it doesn't really scratch an itch. I did just see people say it's too bad that you seemingly cannot use your Apple Watch with the Peloton app to be your heart rate monitor for the Peloton. So this is similar to what Orange Theory situation is where they, you know, there's a point system and everything, and heart rate is a big part of it, and sort of like, you know, how much you're putting into the workout, but you've got to bring your own heart rate monitor. It can't be the watch. And in the case of Peloton, like for me, it's almost any other Bluetooth heart rate monitor except for the watch, you know, and I'm wearing two at that point. And I've got to make sure that my watch isn't paired to it, that is the Peloton that's paired to it. So in many cases, I just ignore that part of the experience and just let the watch be the watch and let the Peloton be the Peloton without heart rate data. You know, and like they made the solution for this a long time ago with GymKit, where you just scan it over NFC and you get the, you know, for like an indoor bike ride, you get the very specific things like distance and pace and everything from the bike that knows what you're doing on the watch, and then the watch knows your heart rate and more things about you, like how you actually burn calories based on your heart rate and your other factors that then sync to the machine. But that just has not taken off. I mean, it's in some very high end stuff, but like that would, it's kind of designed, you know, GymKit is right in the name, for somewhere like Orange Theory, but they did seem not to think that was viable, you know, and they have to make their own accessory that does a very different thing from GymKit. So it's kind of weird. Like, you know, I wrote a thing in 2018, spring 2018, that was, this is where you can find GymKit now, and like whether you want to buy it on your own or use it in a gym. And it hasn't been updated much since then because there's just not much to it, and it's just very limited.
And it's a shame because it seems like such a good thing, but simple to do, tap and go. But until it filters down the lineups to the cheaper models, it's just going to be out of reach to everybody.
Yeah, and the fact that Orange Theory, like, I think that's more like the story to me here than just like Orange Theory is doing this thing with the Apple Watch, but that there's this like side road from GymKit.
Yeah, they're like eschewing Apple's preferred route to do this weird proprietary.
That Apple endorses. Yeah, that Apple endorses through their involvement. And so, you know, GymKit can be its own thing, but if it kind of fails to be adopted, then let's do these other things with like hacky workarounds. And like you mentioned, the nice thing would just be let the watch talk to whatever the machine is, you know, and the system is. I did, someone tweeted at me or DM'd me or emailed me something where they made their own app for using the watch as the heart rate monitor for Peloton and other machines. And I haven't found, this was when I was away last week. And so I saved it somewhere, but I haven't found where I saved it to. And so I've got to go back and hunt for that. But if that works, and then you can just use your Apple Watch as your Peloton heart rate monitor, you know, it won't be the Orange Theory solution, but I think that's really cool for whether it's Peloton or any other machine. I got to go back and hunt and find that. But if it works as advertised, that's compelling. And it's like, then you really wonder, why can't Apple just do this without another app or something? You know, but we'll see. And there's some stuff happening in Apple Pay this week.
Yeah, and just kind of to wrap up the Express Transit situation, debuted in the London Underground, which is fantastic. And I tried it out and it works exactly as advertised. Basically, the speed up is, it's basically the same as if you pre-authorized your Face ID or your watch, and then you went up and you scan the reader. So, like, you know, it just goes like ding, and you go along your day. But you don't have to worry about pre-authorizing because it's just always authenticated for transit. So I just walk out with my watch. I don't have to worry about double-clicking or anything. Just hold it near the reader. It goes ding. I walk in. And then when I get out of the trains, you ding and you go home. It's fantastic. It's basically the experience of having an Oyster card, but I don't need to carry an Oyster card around. And yes, technically, if you do journeys in London like many times a week, it's actually cheaper if you get like monthly travel cards and stuff. But for just general day passes, contactless through Apple Pay or otherwise is the same price as if you bought the tickets. So for me, I'm only going to London, you know, sporadically. And so doing that's perfectly fine. And I just get a really nice experience now. I don't have to worry about Face ID if I want to use my phone. And I generally use my watch and I don't have to double click anymore. Like in, because, and the real benefit is for everyone else in the queue, because most people have not learnt to do the pre-authorization. So I would
so
always
slows them down.
Yeah, so it just slows everybody down, because no, if you before this was a thing, the best way to do it was to, you know, auth your face as you walk up to the thing while you're in the queue. When you get to the actual reader, you scan and go. But no one would actually do that in real life. So people trying to will just fumble around. Oh, it's done it wrong. I've got to do it again. So basically, you're just speeding the queue up for everybody. So it's a win, even if you don't own it.
Because
you're just going to get through the barriers faster. And they have been advertising it incredibly aggressively. They have like big posters up. I've been getting Twitter ads for it. Just like set up express transit, go on the underground. I don't know how effective it's going to be at getting people to do it and get like into that flow of just doing that rather than buying day passes or using Oyster cards and stuff. But for me, I'm definitely on board. I loved it.
Nice. Yeah. I a few things here. I don't have public transportation to get from A to B reliably where I live. It's just not a big enough city, which is too bad. But then, and because of that, there's no need for the Apple Express Transit stuff. But I'm really envious of it, and the next time I go to a big city that can use it, I want to make sure I'm prepared for it, because I do want to use it, and it's just not interesting. I just can't. I don't have it here, so I haven't paid that much attention to it.
And then finally,
on
the Apple Pay line, the Apple credit card, which is something that I don't have, but you could have because you're American, unlike the Express Transit situation. They did the most credit card move yet, in that they literally just offer double cash back on their own products.
For the holidays, until the end of the year, right?
Yeah, through the end of the year, you get 6% cash back and 3% cash back, which if you're buying the spec'd out Mac Pro, works out to be about the price of a high-spec MacBook Pro, so a decent discount. But it's just funny how it's like double cash back is such like a cliche credit card maneuver, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Apple's doing it now, because all their other like 3% cashback offers, whether it's at T-Mobile or Uber and stuff, if you look at the terms and conditions, it says limited time offer. But at least so far, they have not removed any of those partners. So it feels more like longer term, and just like the limited term stuff just to appease lawyers. Whereas the 6% thing is literally like, you know, time pressure of you have to buy something before the end of the month to get an extra 3%.
Yeah, for the next 3 weeks, there's an expiration date after that.
Yeah. And also, we saw the previously announced iPhone financing program for Apple Card go live this week, which is a bit of a surprise because it was slightly earlier than I think we were kind of expecting it to. It's fine. They you can see on the website some nice UI of how it's integrated into the wallet app, and it shows you your payments. And basically, if you've bought an iPhone through this 24-month plan, your minimum charge per month, just the cost of the iPhone financing per month, just gets added to your minimum balance payoff for the Apple Card every month. So you're still only in one place. You only have one number to worry about. It looks really nicely designed. And it gives software integration, obviously. They're not getting rid of iPhone upgrade program and stuff like that for people that don't have Apple Cards, right? Whether it's worldwide or even in the US, because you don't have to have an Apple Card if you don't want to. But if you do have an Apple Card and you want to buy a new phone, this is a nice way to do it. I don't think it's anything like super revolutionary, because, you know, it's basically just replacing the old financing plan they had for the iPhone, which was provided by Barclaycard, which they retired in August as the Apple Card rolled out. But now there's the Apple Card way to do it. And you do get slightly prettier UI and ways to manage it inside your card experience.
Yeah, and so it's nicely integrated now with the wallet app. But there's nothing – it uses your credit limit, right? It doesn't like add on it's not separate from your credit limit, right? It's part of your credit limit, or is it separate from that?
I thought it was separate from the credit limit, but okay. I might be wrong.
Yeah. This is something else I haven't looked really closely at. And it came out after iPhone buying season, which is a little bit unfortunate, but like you said, it came out faster than we expected it would from being teased. So I guess that's a question for both of us then to look at is it just part of the Apple Card, but then it's an iPhone unrelated to your credit limit and monthly payments is like a separate monthly payment, or is it, that's what I was curious about, was if it's just part of your, I think Barclay would be like that. It's part of your credit limit, but then you get like financing terms that are separate from your other balance. It's like you have one limit, but two balances. One might have interest, one may not have interest. And as long as you make a payment of a certain amount then and pay off that other balance first, then you won't be paying interest on the whole thing. That's probably what it is. But if it is separate from your credit limit, then that's even more interesting, because then it's like that's where the iPhone upgrade program would be beneficial, is if you didn't want to use your credit limit for that, then that's a separate loan that's not part of your Apple Pay credit card. So maybe they all just continue to exist, and there's just a different decision process for which one is the best for you at a given point in time.
Yeah, and if you are applicable to get the Apple Card, there's no additional application to get financing. So if you have an Apple Card, you can get the financing if you want it, which is nice. There's not like tiers of approval to benefit.
Nice. Well, they're keeping this thing going. they're not letting it stay second.
They have done more updates to Apple Card than I expected. And they even recently started reporting your credit to credit unions, which they weren't doing until very recently. And then they've been doing these like weird offers, whether it's 6% cashback, the financing programs, the partnerships with T-Mobile and Walgreens, stuff like that. They've done more in the 4 months or whatever it's been out than I would have guessed they would when you told me at the time.
Yeah. And because they've got the partner in Goldman Sachs, there's incentive to not just ride the success of the iPhone business or whatever else and not pay much attention to this, but they want to be able to report back good numbers to Goldman Sachs to continue this partnership. Otherwise, they have to become the issuing bank, when that's not something they want to do. So there's definitely incentive there for Apple to treat this very seriously, I suppose.
Yeah, so I think the next big milestone for the card in terms of like appeal is getting integration with like Mint and third-party financing expenditure.
Yeah, being able to export your data, right? Yeah. And then beyond that, authorized users, where you can have one account, but then other people can have their own card.
Yeah, like shared accounts and joint accounts and that kind of stuff.
Yep. Nice. Well, maybe in 2020. All right, well, that is the Half Arrow podcast for this week. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. That's APOLLOZAC. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMAYA.
You can also email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.